It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll check out some cool science news, including the up-and-coming world of sound tourism. Apparently, people travel to far-off places to hear unique sounds, things like sand dunes booming and singing.
But first, we're talking about a new bill in Wisconsin that would increase the training requirement for doctors. Republican Representative Eric Severson and Republican State Senator Leah Vukmir introduced the legislation last week. Both legislators have a medical background. Representative Severson is a doctor and Senator Vukmir is a nurse.
The bill would apply to graduates of American and foreign medical schools, and if the bill passes, graduates would need 2 years of medical training to get a license instead of just one.
Here to put this bill into context for us is Ed Miller. He's a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Can you tell us something about what prompted Representative Severson and Senator Vukmir to bring this bill to the floor of the state legislature?
I'm not exactly certain because the very few physicians in Wisconsin have no training beyond 1 year. Typically, most of the doctors in today typically do a residency in some area. If they're primary care, they do it in family practice or internal medicine, typically, or pediatrics. But the so-called general practitioner who has 1 year of postgraduate training, which is the first year, which we used to call the internship year, and then goes into practice, are pretty small. And I'm looking at some of their data, it's well less than 1%. And my guess is that those individuals either are doing something else, administration, or they are older doctors who would be grandfathered in by this law.
So it sounds like you're saying after completing residency, which is typically 4 years, it seems as though most doctors would do something like a 2-year fellowship already.
Well, no, the residency would be 3 years after medical school for the shortest, and that would be like internal medicine or family practice. So that would be it's considered 3 years. The first, the so-called internship year is now considered the first year of residency. But that particular year, then two more make the primary care, and it goes from about 3 to about 8, like for a neurosurgeon.
It was last year that Dr. Sheldon Wasserman, the former chair of the Wisconsin Medical Examining Board, told reporters that Wisconsin has become, this is a quote, a dumping ground for a lot of bad physicians who want to get their foot in the American medical system. What is your response for that?
I don't know what data he's looking at. I'm looking at the data from that they have on Wisconsin that was done essentially last year. And it shows less than 1%, depends how you count it. But if it says the number who have rotating internship or transitional year, that would be the 1 year only. It's 0.3% of Wisconsin physicians.
So what do you make of his claim that there are bad physicians in Wisconsin here who come here because it's, I guess, easier?
I have no clue. Because if you look at the data on other states, and I just looked at the data on other states. Virtually all the states only require 1 year. There's some that do require 2 years. Alaska requires 2 years. Most of the others require one year. Some require two. But for anybody to be hired by any major medical group, for example, and Wisconsin has a lot of them, between Marshfield and Aurora and Gunderson, they would all have to be at least, if not board certified, which would require minimally 3 years in things such as family practice, internal medicine, or be at least board eligible, which means they have completed the residency to be able to take the boards. And so they would have the same training, they just wouldn't have yet passed the boards.
Well, let's look more closely at the aspect that applies to foreign medical students. Are training requirements different for graduates from foreign medical schools?
Slightly. They are slightly different, and some states do have a little bit different. Usually, foreign medical graduates are required to have completed a residency rather than this 1 or 2 years have completed a residency in the United States. And so most states do require 3 years for foreign medical graduates. Or I'm looking here, some require two, but most of them do require a full residency, and that would be normally 3 years. as I say, technically they could practice after a year, but normally nobody would hire them. They would have to have 3 years, and all the foreign doctors coming in the United States, you have to have a U.S. residency. So a number of the number of foreign doctors have actually done a residency back in their home country, and then come to the United States and having to do another residency to be able to be licensed.
Do you read in this any sort of concern or bias against foreign medical students?
Well, it could be. It could be, except they would not, as far as I'm aware, pick up many foreign medical graduates because they have to do a residency. So if you look at most of the foreign medical graduates that come in, whereas now it's called international medical graduates, they all had to do 3 years in the United States. And many of them have not been able to get a residency. For example, they may be ear, nose, and throat in, let's say, India, and have done a residency in India, ear, nose, and throat, and then come to the United States, and they can't get into the surgical residency, which is ear, nose, and throat. And so they become a primary care doctor, where Americans are less likely to be interested in it because primary care pays much less than other specialties. So they become for example, a family practitioner. And you may wonder, you look back, and they were trained in ear, nose, and throat. The reason is they couldn't get into a U.S. residency in ear, nose, and throat if they wanted that. But they do in family practice.
Well, as you know, we've been hearing about a primary care shortage, especially in rural Wisconsin, and a projected nurse shortfall down the years. If this were to pass, do you see this affecting those numbers?
It probably wouldn't affect the numbers very much because most of the doctors all that I'm familiar with actually do have done a residency in the United States. Now, some may do maybe a 2 years because they've done a year, back in their home country, so they've given them sort of credit for a year. But they've done at least 2 years in the United States. And so if we go to 2 years, it's not going to make any difference. I don't know anybody's done less than that. Of the current ones. Now, in former times, that wasn't the case. In former times, many physicians, after they graduated medical school, did the 1 year, and they were then licensed. But that's not the case. Plus, the fact is medical school has changed. At one time, you went to 4 years of medical school, and the first time you really saw patients was the year of so-called internship. But today, the second 2 years of medical school are rotations. And you move around different specialties, and you do see patients at that time. So you do get clinical experience in medical school now, in addition to the postgraduate years. Actually, the move is in the other direction. The move is to shorten the amount of training time because we do have the doctor shortage. And they're talking about shortening the training time primarily in the area of medical school, going from 4 years of medical school to 3 years. That's a very debatable proposition, but that's what's currently being discussed.
Ed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime. Thank you very much.
That was Ed Miller, professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point.
The latest issue of Discover magazine doesn't hit newsstands until tomorrow, but we, and consequently you, are in luck today. One of the editors is here to give us a sneak peek at some of the coolest stories in this month's magazine.
Sound tourism, bionic hands, and exploring extreme landscapes in hopes of understanding what life is like on Mars. Gemma Tarlak is here to give us the details on these stories. She's a senior associate editor at Discover magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks.
So the first story you have for us is about sound tourism. This is something that's kind of new. What is sound tourism?
Well, it's really kind of the genius child of an acoustic engineer by the name of Trevor Cox from England. And he noticed in his own work, going around finding all these incredible sound effects, he started plotting them on a map and encouraging other people to send in sound files that he adds to the map. And some of the sounds are truly extraordinary. Booming sand dunes, for example. I think you've got the link on your site. It's kind of difficult to describe, but it's a synchronized avalanche of sand grains. So if you think about sliding down a sand dune, you can actually create music, and it's a very eerie sound. It sounds kind of like the world's largest didgeridoo or something.
And not only do we have a link on our Facebook page, but we also have an actual sound file here that we can play for you now. So let's listen to that. So there you go, those sand dunes making that didgeridoo-like sound. And that really is amazing and a good example of what Trevor is trying to accomplish, get people to actually take a moment. And in fact, that's what he recommends, that if people want to get started, just sort of cut out all the noise and take a moment and listen.
Yes, and you know, when you think about it, just going through our everyday, there are so many sounds that we completely ignore, whether it's the opening and shutting of a door or even the sound of the breath of the person next to you. And he said, you know, unplug your iPod, take off the earbuds, put down the smartphone, and just really listen and appreciate all the different sounds around us. And you'll find a lot of the ordinary sounds are actually quite extraordinary.
Now, I want to go back to those sand dunes for a moment. In the video, which we've got a link to, there are people sort of scooting on their bottoms down this giant mound of sand. Really, that's what makes that noise?
Yeah, and I have to say, when I saw that video, all I could think about was how unpleasant it was growing up on the Jersey Shore and getting sand in my swimsuit. And I just thought, you know, it's a cool sound, but I'm not going to get sand in my pants to make it. I'm sorry. But, yeah, basically they are causing the avalanche. That's what creates the sound. It's the avalanche of sand grains. And apparently if you get enough people to do it and you're at the right dune and the sand grains are dry enough, it actually creates the sound. And one thing he said that I thought was really interesting, the pitch of the sound you hear depends on the size of the sand grains. So there are a booming and singing sand dunes all over the world, places like Chile's Atacama Desert, and in California, in Nevada, in China, Mongolia, and they all have different pitches or different songs, if you want to think of it that way, because of the different size grains of sand.
Wow, so that's pretty amazing. This is something that you could do on any sand dune, but you don't need specialized equipment to pick up a sound like that?
Well, actually, not all sand dunes do it. So I'm sorry if you had grand ideas of going out in the backyard with your sandbox. It's not going to work.
You read my mind.
Yeah, unfortunately, and they're not quite sure why some dunes do it, some don't. And when I was talking to Trevor, he mentioned that he and his team went out to the Mojave to record some booming sand dunes there. And they were so disappointed because they drove, from the airport all the way out into the desert. And they got nothing for the first couple days, and then finally on the last day, it was making the sound for them. So they still don't really understand why some dunes do it, some don't, the exact reason for why they'll do it one day but not another. But it's really a fascinating phenomenon.
So are people, when you propose the idea of sound tourism, how do people react to that? Because at first blush, it sounds a little abstract. You know, I'm going to go somewhere and I'm going to listen to what sort of thing?
Yeah, but again, that really gets back to what Trevor talks about in his book. Really, when you think about it, we are visual creatures generally, and there is just as much richness and depth in sound as there is in sight. So it's really not that different from saying, hey, you got to go to New Zealand to see the mountains, they're beautiful, than saying, hey, you got to go to New Zealand to hear the fur seals when they're mating, it's crazy. It's, you know, it's kind of the same thing, although we often don't think of sound as rich as sight.
Well, another top story that we're looking at and you write about and discover is this new prosthetic, a bionic hand. What is it about this hand that's new and different?
Yeah, well, this is something I covered online last week when the paper came out. And I have to say, for me personally, it was a great story to cover because so much of what I do is kind of less than good news. You know, sea levels are rising, influenza is mutating to be more deadly, et cetera. So it was great to be able to cover this really positive story. This European consortium of researchers got together and for the first time were able to implant tiny, tiny electrodes in the nerves of a patient's arm. And he had lost his hand in an accident about 10 years ago. They implanted the electrodes in his arm and hooked them up to a special prosthetic that had sensors that detected measurements and movements when the prosthetic's tendons changed. And when you think about it, if you run your hand over a book or over the shoulder of the person sitting next to you, your fingers move, sort of creating the contour that you're feeling. And this is how the tendons were measured by the sensors. Once the sensors detected the changes in the prosthetic's tendons, they had a software program that translated the change into an electrical signal that then traveled to the electrodes in his arm and conveyed the actual feeling. So, for example, this patient was able to distinguish between an orange and a baseball, which when you think about it is pretty incredible. He was able, though, to sense how the orange, what you could squeeze, where the baseball was much firmer. And it's just a great story. Again, it's a case study of one patient. They've only tried it with one patient, and it's very early, but it's the results were so positive that they think this could be something very easy to develop in the future, and they could add additional sensors that could measure, say, temperature, so you could tell if you're touching something hot or cold.
And in the world of prosthetics devices, I mean, this is really, I think, amazing news and an amazing step. Any idea of the timeline? You said relatively soon. Is that 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
Well, they didn't want to give one. Of course, that was the question everybody was asking. But just the results were so positive from this one trial. And I have to say that it was kind of sad because after a certain amount of time, they had to remove the electrodes from this poor guy's arm just because of clinical trial protocols. You know, they couldn't leave them in because the trial was completed. So he's without the prosthetic now, unfortunately. But hopefully within the decade, maybe even sooner, we're going to see just fantastic advances built on this.
What did it look like?
It is not the prettiest thing in the world. It's kind of this big, blocky, and I have to also say it's not wireless yet. So they're working on that, and they're working on refining and shrinking all the electronics involved. But it looked kind of like maybe a 1950s very basic robot hand. The lifelike prosthetic is not quite there in this one area.
Hmm. Moving on to the cover story this month in Discover, an astrobiologist is studying alien landscapes, but he's doing it right here where we live on Earth.
Yeah, astrobiologist Chris McKay works for NASA, and he has, I think, kind of a dream job. He travels all over the world to really remote places, the coldest place, the hottest place, the driest place. So he's in the deserts and in Antarctica and all over. And what he's looking for is to figure out, okay, there is life in Antarctica. How is that life existing? How did it evolve? If this life also exists on another planet or on a moon, how can we figure it out? What are the signatures of this life so that we can develop tests, say, for the Curiosity rover on Mars, to see if this kind of life also exists outside our planet? And really fascinating work. And again, he travels to some of the most amazing locations on our planet.
What are some of those locations? Where has he been?
Well, Antarctica and the Arctic and Iceland and, of course, California's Mojave Desert. That keeps coming up in this issue. But also our cover, if you look, it's a really extraordinary photo of this Tanzanian volcano called, and I'm probably going to mangle it, but Oldonyolungai. And this volcano is unique on our planet. It is the only carbonatite lava volcano, and most volcanoes are basalt, but this is the only one on Earth that has this super runny kind of lava. It has a different mineral composition than other types of lava. And they look at this lava at this Tanzanian volcano, and they think that that same kind of lava might be on Venus, because Venus has thousands of miles of lava channels, and they can't really figure out how these lava channels were created. Most lava doesn't travel that far. But this one Tanzanian volcano, they think, has the right super runny, it's kind of gross actually, super runny lava that might explain the volcanoes and the lava channels on Venus. And, who would ever think to look in Tanzania to understand Venus better?
So once he's got the data in hand, and let's use this lava as an example, how do you go about sort of proving that maybe, or trying to prove that it may have some relationship to lava on Venus?
Well, they do a lot of different things. They do a lot of different measurements, and, they're refining all the time the instrumentation to get data from Venus and from, he also studies, for example, one of Saturn's moons, Titan. So they're getting all this refined data, and they're able to compare it to things on Earth and try to figure out, do we see similarities? Do we see the same signatures? It's still definitely a work in progress, but just their understanding has increased.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Gemma, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha.
The March on Washington and the march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, these marches symbolize key moments and achievements in the civil rights movement, like helping to pass the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
But the Meredith March Against Fear from Memphis to Jackson is a far lesser known march that turned out to be a turning point in civil rights history. Our next guest calls it the last great march of the Martin Luther King era.
It was the march out of which the Black Power movement gained momentum, and moderates and radicals in the civil rights movement were increasingly at odds. And it all began with just one man, James Meredith, setting up from the Peabody Hotel in Memphis.
Here with us to talk about the march is Aram Gudsousian. He is the chair of the University of Memphis History Department, and we'll be talking about his new book, Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. Aram, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thank you, Gene.
Well, it's great to have you along, and the book really looks fascinating, I have to tell you. If you could start by sort of setting the stage for this march. Veronica, in her introduction, mentioned the March on Washington and Selma that everybody is familiar with. This march, not so much. So it's set the scene for us. It's
sure.
1966. There's been a lot of action in the civil rights movement, and all of a sudden James Meredith announces at a press conference that he's going to make this march.
Sure. So on the one hand, there's been this great liberal momentum over the course of the 1960s through mass demonstrations, as you mentioned, such as the March on Washington and Birmingham and Selma, and through some great legislative triumphs at the federal level, particularly the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. But in that year, between the triumph of Selma and the Voting Rights Act and June of 1966, when my story begins, it has been a year of sort of uncertainty. The race riot at Watts has occurred. There's been a controversy over the so-called Moynihan Report, which was generated controversy for blaming African-American family life for some of the problems that the more deeper entrenched problems in the Black community. And there's a rising group of African-American militants, particularly in northern cities, who are proclaiming a sort of a new kind of politics, a more confrontational style of politics, and moving more toward Black nationalism rather, because of their frustrations with what they see as a uncooperative federal government moving way too slow, and with white liberals who are just sort of uncertain allies. So they want to sort of focus inward and build up the power of the Black community. And they're also very critical of the strategies of Martin Luther King in terms of nonviolence. Not necessarily of the violent revolutionaries, but more that they at least are asserting the right to self-defense. So that sort of gives you the broader political picture of the civil rights movement heading into June of 1966.
And so then James Meredith, and a lot of people will remember him as the first African-American student at the University of Mississippi, and this was 3 or 4 years after that.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a press conference, announces he's going to march from Memphis to Jackson. And what two things. What is the significance of James Meredith sort of making that announcement? And the significance of that route from Memphis to Jackson.
Mm-hmm. So Meredith, of course, as you mentioned, is famous for integrating Ole Miss and spawning really a constitutional crisis because ultimately federal intervention was ultimately necessary to get him at Ole Miss and to protect him there. But he's kind of drifted off the radar screen a little bit, and that's partly due to his own sort of staunch individualism. He wants to be an important factor within the civil rights movement, but he's critical of the civil rights movement itself and of established organizations. So he decides he's going to launch this march. And in terms of symbolism, he sees this march from Memphis to Jackson as sort of his way of recreating a route that he had taken often, because he was sort of, during the Ole Miss crisis leading up to his integration, his home base was Memphis for a while, and Jackson was his home. And Route 51 was the route that he constantly drove along that way. So his idea was that he would walk 220 miles from Memphis to Jackson. And along the way, he would do two things, as he saw it. One, he would encourage African-Americans to register to vote. The Voting Rights Act had passed the previous year. There was an election coming up. And he saw this also as part of his own, ultimately personal ambition to get back involved in Mississippi politics. The other thing that he wanted to do was destroy what he called sort of a culture of fear in Mississippi, that what was keeping Black people from achieving equality was that they were constantly afraid of white reprisals, and justifiably so. But his idea was that if James Meredith, you know, perhaps the most hated Black man in Mississippi among white people because of what he'd done to Ole Miss, if he could do this walk without fear, then others would follow in his footsteps in terms of defying this culture.
And speaking of symbolism, the march began in the right outside the lobby of the old Peabody Hotel in downtown Memphis, which today people think of as being this quaint touristy place with the ducks walking around and the fountain and all of that. But you do reference it in the book that there is symbolism there, and it does mean something.
Mm-hmm. The famous line is that the Mississippi Delta begins in the lobby of the Peabody Hotel. So it's something of a bastion of privilege, right? It's a bastion of power. And for those in Mississippi, those large planters, the Peabody was important to them. It was sort of their home base for Memphis operations where they traveled constantly. So Meredith starting right outside the doors of the Peabody, there's a certain symbolic value to that. And he crosses through Memphis, and he goes from downtown Memphis. He crosses Beale Street, sort of the home of the blues in Memphis, and into South Memphis, which is an African-American neighborhood. And from there, he starts walking down 51. He actually passes by Graceland, Elvis Presley's great manor, about 8 miles south of the city.
And when he started, it should be noted, he wasn't alone exactly, but he was pretty close to it.
Mm-hmm. He did not envision this as a mass march. He saw it as sort of his quest, and if others wanted to come with him, and if they were willing to be independent and self-sufficient, then they could follow in his footsteps. And that was part of his ideology, the sort of idea of a self-sufficient, self-protecting man who wasn't going to impose on a local community and wasn't going to involve women and children either in his march. He saw that as irresponsible. He was a critic of nonviolence in his own way, probably more from a conservative end than a radical end. So as he starts walking, it gets some media attention, but it's seen as sort of the quirky endeavor of this very, some ways, odd man.
And then a day or two into the march, he winds up getting shot.
The second day of his march, his first day in Mississippi, he passes through the town of Hernando, which is the first town you would hit if you were walking down Route 51, and he gets a nice response from the local African-American community. People, there's more than 100 people there, and they shake his hand, and they promise him they're going to register to vote, and he's happy. He feels like, this is the first time that I'm really accomplishing what I set out to do. These people are going to defy this culture. He's optimistic, and he was particularly proud of the men who stood up and were defying the glaring whites across the town square who were checking him out. But about a few miles south of Hernando that same day, while he's walking along this dipping stretch of road, a man comes out from the side of the road and shoots him 3 times. He peppers him with birdshot, sort of the scattered pellets, and he's very severely wounded. And from there, it transforms the meaning of the march. It goes from being one man's endeavor into all of a sudden a civil rights extravaganza.
And that is a good place for us to take a break, and we're going to do just that. Aram Gudsousian is with us, chair of the University of Memphis History Department. We're talking with him about his book, Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. We are back with Aram Gudsousian speaking about the Meredith March, the last great march of the Martin Luther King Jr. era. And before the break, we were talking about day two of the march when James Meredith wound up getting shot and how that turned out to be kind of a pivotal point in the arc of this march. And Aram Gudsousian, if you could tell us a little bit more about that. So what exactly changed? I mean, did it really just add a whole bunch of energy to this thing that really hadn't had a lot beforehand?
Or it changed everything about the march itself. Really, it was just associated purely with James Meredith before then. Once he gets shot, he becomes a symbol, a victim as much as anything else. And people think this is going to replicate the cycle that we've seen in Birmingham when demonstrators got attacked with fire hoses, or in Selma when there was the so-called Bloody Sunday when the marchers were hit with tear gas, that it would inspire this liberal outrage, it would lead to more civil rights legislation. There was even a civil rights bill on the table at the time in Congress, so they assumed that it would now get passage. It also brings to Memphis, to the home base of the march, it brings Martin Luther King of SCLC, his organization. It brings SNCC, this young militant organization led by Stokely Carmichael. It brings Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP, Whitney Young, head of the Urban League, Floyd McKissick, head of CORE. And with them, people are flooding into Memphis determined to carry on Meredith's march. It is his name only at this point.
But you talk about all those people, Martin Luther King, Stokely Carmichael, the rest. There's a lot of different personalities tied up in all of that. How did that play out maybe not just in the media, but behind the scenes as well.
Mm-hmm. So right from the beginning, that is playing out both in a public and in a more private realm. The first night of speeches, when they all come to Memphis and are speaking at a mass meeting, they're all sort of articulating their different political philosophies without directly challenging one another. And then that night, they're having a late-night meeting at the Lorraine Motel, famous, of course, for where King gets shot two years later in Memphis and dies. And it's basically a huge strategy session that turns into a late-night argument about what this march is about. And basasically, the young militants, people like Stokely Carmichael, are able to drive out the NAACP and the Urban League, because they realize that if these more established civil rights organizations that are really geared toward Washington, D.C. and reform and good relationships with the president are involved in the march, it's not going to take on the character they want. So they essentially render themselves unworkable in terms of working with these groups. So that leaves Martin Luther King as sort of the more moderating influence on the march, and this rising generation of radicals, of people like Carmichael, who are pushing the movement in new directions.
And we hear that's where we first hear the term Black Power.
Mm-hmm. So SNCC has already determined that Black Power is going to sort of encapsulate their new philosophy, or the evolution of their philosophy, to really be geared toward independent black politics, to articulate the need for self-defense instead of nonviolence, and to sort of really emphasize the issues of black pride and culture. But what the march does is it gives them a forum to turn it into a slogan and into something that ultimately gets recognized as the new direction in black politics by the late 1960s. It's about halfway through the march when Carmichael returns from a brief hiatus and comes to Greenwood, which is in the heart of the Mississippi Delta, where he's really helped to urge the diversion of the march. Originally wasn't going to go through the Delta, but he brings it to Greenwood, where he has a long relationship with a lot of locals, where he was an organizer during Freedom Summer 2 years earlier. And it's there that, with about 1,000 people present in the heart of Black Greenwood, where he unleashes the slogan of Black Power.
And so while all of this is sort of playing out in the background and in the public eye, the march continues, and there are some pretty good photographs in your book of, in some cases, of the march going by white people with Confederate flags and sort of taunting and jeering and that sort of thing. So it was interesting. You've got all these different things playing out. You've got the spokespeople, and then you've got the march itself playing mm-hmm. out mm-hmm. Through villages and roads and passersby on the street.
Yeah, and there's just a whole host of extraordinary stories practically every day of the march, in terms of everything from people who decide that they're going to march and they don't really care anymore about sort of the reprisals that they're going to face from the white community. And that could be anything from violence to a lost job to denied credit or what have you. You have this whole debate over types of white resistance. Sort of the white elites in Mississippi are trying to push people away from the demagoguery of the past. The governor, Paul Johnson, is basically saying, let's try to protect these marchers. Let's keep them moving. Let's avoid more incidents, and that way we'll avoid federal intervention and media attention, and this will just be, we'll be able to go back to the status quo when this is done. But then there's a Klan presence. Somewhere in southwest Mississippi, not on the march route, there's the murder of an innocent black man simply with the idea that it will attract Martin Luther King there so they can murder him too. There's all sorts of extraordinary stories along the way of everyone from poor black sharecroppers to white elites to everything in between. There's a Mississippi story here that's really vital.
And is the media picking up on this by this point? I mean, are TV networks there? Are local media covering it?
Sure. It's extremely well documented. It's a historian's dream in that regard, in that it is. There's a great amount of press from everything from the established New York Times and L.A. Times and so on. There's the black presses there. There's the wire services are reporting and churning out all sorts of different stories. And the press is kind of its own story on the march, too, because for the marchers and for march leaders in particular, they're very frustrated with the march, with the press coverage of the march, because they see it as sensationalizing the more radical aspects and sensationalizing their internal conflicts, when they should really be focused on the larger issues as they see it, which is that Mississippi remains a Jim Crow state and that black people in Mississippi are enduring third world style poverty.
And so everything we've been describing happened during this march, and yet the march itself lasted for, what, a little over a month?
3 weeks.
Three weeks.
22 days to be true.
22 days. Mm-hmm. All this happened then, and they do arrive in Jackson. And what's it like when they actually get there?
Well, it's the largest civil rights demonstration in Mississippi history. And for those in Jackson, you talk to people in Jackson, who were there at that time, they see this as an important moment in local history. At least 15,000 people are there, national dignitaries from all over. You know, it's got the Kings and the Carmichaels and so on, but all sorts of local leaders. And people, you know, are it's like the sea of humanity going through the narrow streets of Jackson. So it's in that way, it's a great triumph on a local scale. On a national scale, it kind of signals something else because, as you mentioned, it was the last great march. It was the last time these civil rights organizations are able to come together, put on this type of mass demonstration that generates a national conversation that is designed to try to appeal to the larger conscience of America. So an era kind of comes to an end, if you will, with the end of this march as well. King can, at the end of the march, can really no longer envision working with SNCC, even as he's got a good personal relationship with someone like Stokely Carmichael. He can no longer envision a cooperation between the two organizations.
And let me ask you to speculate a little bit about the implications of that. I mean, the fact that you've got these well-known people involved in civil rights, sort of everybody having to choose their own path, even though they have a common goal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's always been the case in African-American politics, just like in any sort of larger political realm, right? That there is a great deal of nuance and a great deal of debate that animates African-American politics going back to the era of slavery. But what the Meredith March does is it captures this it in a particularly dramatic fashion, that it occurs over 3 weeks and that those debates really surface in the public eye. And if you want to talk about bickering civil rights organizations, that occurs even in their moments of great consensus. But what's changed now is that it surfaced in the public realm in ways that it hasn't before.
Early on in the interview, you said that James Meredith had a couple of goals here. He wanted to encourage African-Americans to exercise the right to vote. He wanted to destroy the culture of fear. Was he able to accomplish those goals, or did the march wind up being something different altogether?
You know, in some ways, it's true. Meredith did accomplish those two goals. There were over 4,000 people who registered to vote along the march route over the course of the march, over the course of those 3 weeks. And that's because as the marchers would arrive in a town, they would try to stage a voter registration drive. The first of these was in Batesville, Mississippi. And there's an extraordinary story there where they registered to vote a man who was at least 106 years old, which means that he was born a slave. And he's registering to vote for the first time in his life. And again, they register over 4,000 people. In some places, it leads to sort of a new political movement on a local scale, like when they come to Grenada, Mississippi, which was really, civil rights movement had not really affected it in any way, shape, or form up till then. And they really sort of kick off their local movement, beginning with the Meredith March. In other places, it helps to revitalize it, at least for a brief time. So it has very much this impact on a local scale. And those two goals are interrelated. You know, if you're going to register to vote, you are defying that culture of fear.
We've only got about 45 seconds left here, but this march, you know, has been overshadowed, I think, a little bit by Washington, Selma, mm-hmm. and realizing you wrote a book about it, how fair is that?
Well, the other ones are more feel-good stories to a certain degree. They have more of a clear beginning and an end and an accomplishment in the sense of the legislation that comes out of them and the sense of triumph that comes out of that. The story of the Meredith March is in some ways more ambiguous, but I think it's a more complete way. If you're going to tell one story of the civil rights movement to represent a larger political narrative, I think the Meredith March is more appropriate because it allows you to talk about both this liberal impulse and the dynamism of black power in both its positive and negative manifestations.
Well, Aram Gudsousian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Appreciate your time. We've been talking with Aram Gudsousian. His new book is called Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear.